Oh, fine. Really, she's been great about it. And she's doing brilliantly at ballet. Enter a tunnel. Lion cuts out. The tightening knot in my stomach makes it hard to focus on the stress quiz. When did I start lying to my mother? I don't mean the obligatory daughter-mother falsehoods. 11 at the latest. Never tried it. 3 Cokes, but everyone's wearing them. He slept on the floor. Yes, a friend of Deb's. No, not overdrawn. In the sale, yes, an absolute bargain. Fine, couldn't be better. Those lies aren't really lies at all, but mutual protection. When you're young, your mother shields you from the world because she thinks you're too young to understand. And when she's old, you shield her because she's too old to understand, or to have any more understanding inflicted on her. The curve of life goes, want to know? No. Don't want to know. What I'm talking about here is the lies to my mother about being a mother. I tell her Emily has coped well with the departure of her best friend, even though I haven't heard about it. I'd rather Mum thought I was a failure at work than a stranger to my children. She thinks I have it all, and she's so pleased for me. I can't tell her, can I? It would be like finding out that after Cinderella got to live in the palace, the prince put her back on hearth-cleaning duty. 7:47 p.m. The Cloisters Hotel, York. I ring my mother back. She sounds breathless. With a little gentle prompting from me, she admits that, yes, she has been feeling a bit under the weather lately, which, translated from mother speak, means she has lost all feeling in her limbs and her vital organs are shutting down. Oh, God. I don't even bother to replace the handset before keying in the number of my sister, Julie, who lives just round the corner from Mum. Stephen, Julie's eldest, answers the phone. He reports that his mum's watching The Street, but he'll get her. Julie's tone still takes me by surprise. The adoring lisp of my little sister has been supplanted in recent years by something tense and grudging. Whenever we speak these days, she seems to be spoiling for a fight about a grievance that's too painful to have a name. I got away, and Julie didn't. Julie fell pregnant and got married when she was 21, and had 3 kids by the time she was 28, and I didn't. Julie's husband is an electrician, and mine is an architect. Julie lives a mile away from our mother and tries to look in every day, and I don't. Julie, who is good with her hands, brings in a bit of extra cash by making tiny curtains and bits of furniture for a local doll's house company, and I, who am good with my head, don't. In fact, I probably invest my clients' money indirectly in the Far Eastern sweatshops that are driving Julie's employer out of business. Julie has been abroad once, Rimini, unlucky with the weather, whereas it is not unknown for me to go twice in a single week. And none of this is anybody's fault. But we exist now, my sister and I, in an atmosphere of guilt and blame. I ask Julie if she thinks Mum should go and see a doctor, and her sigh blows across the Pennines, flattening trees in its path. "Mum won't listen to me," she says. "If you're that bothered, why don't you get up here and tell her yourself?" I'm explaining what my schedule has been like when Julie jumps in. "Anyway, it's not physical. She's had some bother with men coming round to the flat. Said they were after money. Dad owed them." "Why didn't you tell me?" From my sister's living room floats the mournful theme tune of Coronation Street. Julie and I both loved that soap when we were kids. There was a period when we fought furiously over the affections of Ray Langton, a mechanic with dark wavy hair, until he got squashed under one of his own cars. I haven't seen it in 20 years. "I left a couple of messages on that machine, Kath," says my sister. "But you're never there, are you?" 8:16 p.m. The conference is for dot-com entrepreneurs, or what's left of them. The guys who persuaded the city that they could read the future turned out to have been talking crystal balls. You wouldn't believe how much venture capital has been thrown at firms who were going to sell designer clothes on the net. But guess what? People prefer to go to shops and try stuff on. Women fund managers were a lot less badly burned in the meltdown. As always, we were better at evaluating risk-reward. We spent far less on untried stock than our male colleagues. People said we were lucky. I don't agree. I think it's innate. Women like to have some reliable staples in the cupboard to keep those small mouths fed when the saber-toothed tiger is blocking the entrance to the cave. Unpacking my suitcase before going down to dinner, I find a large envelope marked "Do not open till Sunday" in Richard's handwriting. I open it. My Mother's Day cards. One is a print of Ben's hands in red paint. I half smile, half grimace at the thought of the mess that must have attended its making. Emily's has a drawing of me on the front. I am wearing a crown and holding a green cat, and I am so tall I dwarf my nearby palace. Inside she has written, "I love my mummy. Love is special. It makes my heart sparkle and treasure appear." I can't believe it. Have forgotten Mother's Day. Mum will never forgive me. Dial reception. Can you get me a number for Interflora? To Kate Reddy, from Jack Abelhammer.
Will you come to New York City? Or should I? Stop. Thinking about you. Stop.
To Jack Abelhammer, from Kate Reddy. Don't. Stop. Must remember. Get dishwasher fixed. Stair carpet. Fun transitions to be arranged. No fuck-ups. Call Jill. Application form for nursery for Ben. Emily schools now. Remind Rich to get cash out for babysitter. Pay Juanita. Change computer password. Paula's birthday, damn. George Michael tickets. Book spa treatment. Call Dad and tackle about his debts. Visit Mum. Buy Sinatra CD. Ginseng for better memory or ginkgo thingy. Chapter 20. The Way We Were. 3:39 a.m. Woken by the doorbell. It's Rob, our neighbour from three doors down. Says he heard a noise and saw a group of lads by our car, but he shouted and they ran off. Richard goes out to inspect the damage. Side window completely smashed in, forked lightning crack across the back one. Of course the alarm didn't go off. The car alarm, usually triggered by a cat's breath, is hopelessly mute when actual burglary is taking place. Rich goes out to tape up the windows while I get on the phone to Pronto Glass, 24-hour service. Sorry, your call is held in a queue, due to demand. Please hold while we try to connect you. Demand? What demand? It's 4 o'clock in the bloody morning. If you know the extension you require, please press 1. If you wish to speak to an operator, please press 2. I press 2. Please hold while we try to connect you. Your call will be answered shortly. Thank you for choosing Pronto Glass. If you wish to speak to an operator, please press 3. I press 3. Sorry, your call cannot be taken at the moment. Please try later. Think of all the time that must be wasted every day in those echoing antechambers where calls wait. Hell, contrary to what Sartre said, is not other people. Hell is trying to get through to other people while listening to 7 minutes of Vivaldi played on panpipes. I decide to get dressed and crack in early to some work. This is a good time of day to talk to Tokyo. But as I'm fumbling with my blouse buttons in the still dark bedroom, there is a yell from above. When I go up, the baby is standing in his cot, remonstrating with the monster who has dragged him from sleep. He jabs a debater's accusing forefinger at his invisible assailant. I know, sweetheart, I know. Some bad men have woken us all up. Ben is so spooked he won't go back to sleep. I lift him onto the sofa bed, which is just next to the cot, and lie down beside him.
Ooh,
he moans.
Ooh.
So I get up and fetch the scruffy little kangaroo and tuck it under his arm. Babies have this magic spot between their brows. If you stroke your finger down over it and along the ridge of their nose, their eyes close automatically like a human roller blind. My boy hates sleep. It separates him from the life he relishes. But he starts to drift off, the indigo eyes emptying of thought. I lie there contemplating the cracks on the ceiling around the light fitting where bits of plaster are starting to peel off. Even my ceiling has stress eczema. I imagine a finger stroking my own brow and, clothes wrinkling around me, I tumble into a crowded dream. 6:07 a.m. Richard comes into Ben's room to relieve me. Baby is splayed flat out like a puppy. We talk in whispers.
I did say buying the Volvo was a bad idea, Kate.
Some little bastards break into our car, and it's my fault.
No, just that round here it's clearly a provocation, isn't it?
Come off it, Rich. Even Tony Benn doesn't think property's theft anymore.
He laughs. And who was it who once said crime is the just punishment for an unjust society?
I never said that. When did I say that?
Shortly before taking possession of your first open-top Golf, Mrs. Engels.
My turn to laugh. Encouraged, Rich starts kissing my hair and puts an exploratory hand down my front. Even when you're not in the mood, startling how quickly nipples stiffen to iced gems. Rich is just pulling me down onto the Winnie the Pooh rug when Ben sits bolt upright, gives his parents a how could you look, and then points to himself. Did I mention that babies are anti-sex, too? You'd think they'd have some nostalgia for the act that made them. Instead, they appear to have an alarm to see off the threat of rivals, wailing on cue as though their cry was wired up to your bra clasp. Rueful Rich sweeps up his son and goes down to an early breakfast. Try to doze off again, but I can't sleep for thinking how Richard and I have changed. First time we met was 15 years ago at university. I was picketing Barclays Bank, and he was opening an account there. I shouted something about South Africa. How dare you invest in brutality? And Rich walked over to our righteous huddle, and I handed him a leaflet, which he studied politely.
My, that does sound bad, he said, before inviting me for coffee.
Richard Shattuck was the poshest man I had ever met. When he spoke, he sounded as though Kenneth Branagh had swallowed Kenneth Moore. Forearmed with the knowledge that all public schoolboys were emotionally stunted Burks, I was unclear what to do when it became clear that this one was capable of more affection than I had ever known. Rich didn't want to save the world, like my idealistic friends. He just made it a better place simply by being in it. We made love for the first time 6 days later in his college room, under the eaves. The sun was falling in a dusty gold column through the skylight as he solemnly unpinned my cyclists against the bomb badge and said,
I'm sure the Russians will sleep more soundly, Kate, for knowing you have passed your cycling proficiency test.
Had I ever laughed at myself before? Certainly the sound that came out that night was rusty with lack of use, a stopped-up spring gurgling into life.
Your Bourneville chocolate laugh, Richard called it, because it's dark and bitter and northern, and it makes me want to eat you.
It's the sound I still like best, the sound of when we were us. I remember how much I loved his body, but even more I loved the way my body felt in relation to his. For every straight edge, a curve. The vertebrae down his back, like rocky steps down into a cave of pleasure. By day we cycled across the fens and shouted, Hill, whenever we felt the slightest incline, but at night we explored another terrain. When Rich and I first started sleeping together, I mean actually sleeping, not having sex, we would lie in the middle of the bed face to face, close enough to feel the gusts of each other's warm nighttime breath. My breasts would be pushed against his chest, and my legs, I still can't figure this out, disappeared over and under his like a mermaid's tail. When I think of us in bed back then, I think of the shape of a seahorse. Over time, we began to face outwards. You could probably date that, our first separation, to the purchase of a king-size bed in the late 80s. And then, with the arrival of our first child, the battle for sleep began. Bed became a place you sank into rather than dived into. We, who had slipped in and out of consciousness as easily as we slipped in and out of each other, entrances and exits blurred by kissing, were now jealously guarding our place of rest. My body shocked me by bristling at anything that threatened to take away its remaining strength. A stray knee or elbow was enough to spark a boundary war. I remember starting to notice how loud Rich's sneezes were, how eccentrically articulated. "Ha-choo," he went. "Ha-choo." When we were still students, we had travelled round Europe by train, and one night we wound up in a small hotel in Munich, where we collapsed in giggles on the bed. It looked like a double, but when you pulled the cover back, it turned out to be two mattresses, divided and united by a thin wooden strip, which made any meeting in the middle an effort, rather than an inevitability. It all felt so Teutonic. "You be East Germany, and I'll be West," I remember saying to Rich as we lay there on our separate halves in the light of the street lamp. We laughed, but in time I came to wonder whether the Munich arrangement was the true marriage bed, practical, passionless, putting asunder what God had joined together. 7:41 a.m. After breakfast, Ben, wearing a bib like a Jackson Pollock, is terribly clingy. Paula peels him off me when Winston arrives to drive me to work. "All right, sweetheart, it's all right," I hear Paula say as I pull the door behind me. Sitting in the back of Pegasus, I try to read the Financial Times to bring myself up to speed for my presentation, but I can't concentrate. There is music playing, a jazz piano arrangement of something I can almost place. Someone to watch over me? It sounds as though the pianist has smashed the tune into 1,000 pieces and keeps throwing them into the air to see which way they land. The riffs are like a man shuffling a pack of cards, only instead of paper, the cards are made of sound. Winston hums along, holding the main line of the tune and occasionally letting out a little whoop to salute the pianist for a particularly cunning resolution. This morning, my driver's ease and pleasure feels like an insult, a rebuke. I want him to stop. "Do you think we could avoid the new north lights, Winston, and cut round the back? I'm not convinced this is the quickest way." He doesn't answer for a while, but allows the track to finish. Then, with the final chord still thrumming in the air, he says,
"You know, lady, where I come from, it takes a long time to do things suddenly."
"Kate, my name is Kate."
"I know what your name is," he says. "Way I see it, rushing around just a waste of time. Fly too fast, lady, and you pass your nest."
The laugh I laugh sounds darker than usual. Well, I'm afraid that is the more leisurely perspective afforded to the driver of the minicab. Winston doesn't bite back at my snottiness. He just gives it a long gaze in the mirror and says thoughtfully,
"You think I want to be you? You don't even want to be you."
That's it. "Look, I don't pay you for psychotherapy. I pay you to get me to Broadgate in the shortest time possible, a feat which seems increasingly beyond you. If you don't mind, I'll get out here. It's quicker to walk." As I hand over the 20 and Winston digs into his pocket for change, he begins to sing, "There's a somebody I'm longing to see. I hope that he turns out to be someone to watch over me." 8:33 a.m. Offices of Edwin Morgan Forster. Shoot out of lift, straight into Celia Harmsworth.
"Something on your jacket, dear?" smirks the head of human resources.
"Just back from the cleaners, actually."
I glance down at my shoulder to see a smeary mess, an epaulette of Ben's banana porridge.
"No, God, how can you do this to me?"
"I'm amazed how you manage this job, Catherine," coos Celia, clearly delighted at further proof that I can't.
Celia is one of those spinsters who adored being the only woman in a man's world. It was a license to feel pretty before girlies like me showed up and ruined her monopoly.
"Must be such a struggle with all those kiddies," she offers helpfully. "I was saying to Robin Cooper Clark when you were away for half-term, was it? I don't know how she does it."
"Two."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Two. All those kiddies. I have two of them. That's one less than Robin has."
Turn on my heel, walk over to desk, shrug off stained jacket, shove in bottom drawer. Incredible noise from the window.
Out on the ledge, the pigeons have decided to move in together. The male is sitting there with a twig in his mouth, looking faintly foolish and disbelieving. I recognize the expression. It's the look Rich gives when I bring home a flat pack of shelves for self-assembly. The female, meanwhile, is busy forming a heap of other twigs into a raft-like structure, roughly the size of a dinner plate. Oh, this is great. Now they're building a nest. Guy, did you get on to the corporation about the Hawkman? Damn pigeons are about to start a breeding program out there. I check my neck in handbag mirror for any Ben bites. No, all clear. And then I stalk coolly into meeting with Robin Cooper Clark and other senior managers to begin my presentation. It goes remarkably well. All eyes in the room are glued on me, especially those of the bastard Chris Bunce. I'm obviously starting to command serious respect. The tactic of behaving like a man, never mentioning the children, etc., is clearly paying off. As I switch from slides to overheads, it suddenly occurs to me that I am the only person in the room without a penis. Not a good thought to have right now, Kate. Can we not think about dicks in a gathering of 17 men? Talking of which, do they have to stare at me quite so intently? Look down. I'm wearing red Agent Provocateur demi-tasse bra under white voile shirt, grabbed from chest of drawers in half dark at 4:30. Oh, Jesus. I look like Pamela Anderson at the Oscars. 11:37 a.m. Sit in lady's loo with cheek pressed up against the cubicle wall to cool furious blush. Tiled in black marble, riddled with white stars, the wall is like a map of the universe. I feel as though I'm being sucked into deep space and more than happy to go there. How about disappearing into a black hole for a few millennia till the memory of public humiliation fades? I used to smoke in here when things got desperate. Since I gave up, I sing under my breath. I am strong. I am invincible. I am woman. It's a Helen Reddy song from when I was at school. I loved the fact that she had the same name as me, and she sounded, well, just so full of it. So confident that you could deal with anything life threw at you. At college, when Deborah and I were getting ready for a night out, we used to play the record over and over to psych ourselves up. Dance round the room, playing catch with Deb's Action Man. After his leg broke off, Deb said we'd have to call him Inaction Man, after all our useless husbands. Oh yes, I am wise, but it's wisdom born of pain. Yes, I've paid the price, but look how much I've gained. I am strong. I am invincible. I am woman. Do I believe in equality between the sexes? I'm not sure. I did once, with all the passionate certainty of someone very young who knew absolutely everything and therefore nothing at all. It was a nice idea, equality. Noble. Indisputably fair. But how the hell was it supposed to work? They could give you good jobs and maternity leave, but until they programmed a man to notice you were out of toilet paper, the project was doomed. Women carry the puzzle of family life in their heads. They just do. As a mother, I see that more and more clearly. Every night on the way home from the city, I watch the women scurrying along in the Lucozade light of the street lamps, bags of shopping balancing briefcases, or twitching at bus stops like overwound clockwork toys. Not long ago, my friend Philippa told me that she and her husband had drawn up a will. Phil said she wanted a clause stipulating that, in the event of her death, Mark would promise to cut the children's fingernails. He thought she was joking. She wasn't joking. One Saturday last autumn, I got back from a Boston trip to find Richard in the hall, all set to take our two out to a party. Emily, hair uncombed, appeared to have a dueling scar on one cheek. It was ketchup from lunch. Ben, meanwhile, was bent double, wearing something very small and dotted in apricot that I didn't recognize. On closer inspection, it turned out to be an outfit belonging to one of Emily's dolls. When I suggested to my husband that our offspring looked as though they were going out to beg on the underground, Rich said that if I was going to be critical, I should do it myself. I was going to be critical. I would do it myself. To Candy Stratton, from Kate Reddy. simply marvelous day so far. I've just shown breasts in error to head of investment and the troops. Chris Bunce came up to me afterwards and said, "You were a total pro in there, Kate, with knobs on." Laughed like a drain and said something about putting me on his website. What website? Plus, Abelhammer has invited me for rendezvous in New York. Why men all bull and cock? To Kate Reddy, from Candy Stratton. Hun, don't worry. You have terrific tits. Penis envy is so yesterday. Hello, boob envy. Bunce is a piece of shit. His website will be Jerkoff Central. Hope you're going to meet up with Hammer Man in New York City. He sounds great. I hate you when you act British. Candida Thrush kisses. 1:11 p.m. Lunch with Robin Cooper Clark and a new client, Jeremy Browning, at Tartuffe. Located in the penthouse of a building overlooking Royal Exchange, the restaurant has the kind of hush that, outside a monastery, only money can buy. This must be the silence they call golden. The low seats are scooped out of toffee leather, and the waiters arrive on casters. The menu is my least favorite kind. Chops for chaps, with no concessions to the female palate. When I ask our waiter if there's a salad I could have, he says, "Mais oui, madame," and offers me something with gésier in it. I nod uncertainly, and Robin gives a little cough and says, "Roast throat, I believe." How can anyone swallow a throat? I say that I'd like the salad, but could they please hold the throats? On Robin's lips there is an Alec Guinness ghost of a smile, but the waiter is not amused. Red blood is the currency of the neighborhood. "Any relation of the Worcestershire Reddies?" Jeremy asks, as Robin consults the wine list. Our client must be in his early 50s, but he's in good shape, and he knows it. Ski bronzed from the neck up, gym-bulked shoulders, succulent with success. "No, I shouldn't think so. I'm from a bit farther north."
"The borders?"
"No, more Derbyshire and Yorkshire. We moved about."
"Ah, I see."
Having established that I am no one worth knowing, and no one who will know anyone worth knowing, our new client feels safe to blank me. Over the past decade, my country has become a classless society, but the news has been slow to reach the people who own it. For men like Jeremy, England still ends at Hyde Park, and then there is Scotland, where they go to kill things in August. The North, that great expanse of land between SW1 and Edinburgh, which is best crossed by plane or at night in the sleeper car of a fast train, is a foreign country to them. Jeremy Browning's forebears may have conquered India, but you wouldn't get them going to anywhere as remote as Wigan. Robin would never, could never, treat me as Jeremy does, but then he spent the last 20 years with Jill, who knows in her bones that snobs are a joke, and that, in every sense, women mean business. I get a real kick out of watching my boss on these occasions. Convivial, clubbable, and effortlessly smarter than any of his clients, he nonetheless has a way of making them feel as though they're the captain of the winning team. Seeing me sidelined by the Browning version of events, he gently but firmly tries to draw me back into the conversation.
"Now, Kate here is the High Priestess of Monetary Policy. She's really the person you need to explain the mysterious workings of the Federal Reserve."
And then, a few minutes later, when our guest has a mouthful of squab,
"Actually, Jeremy, Kate's funds delivered our best returns in the past 6 months, at what's been a pretty bumpy time for equities by any standards. Wouldn't you say so, Kate?"
I love him for it, but it's no use. There are some men who will always prefer to deal with another man, any man, rather than a woman, and Jeremy Browning is one of them. I can see him struggling to place me. I'm not married to him. Clearly, I'm not his mother. I didn't go to school with his sister, and I'm sure as hell not going to go to bed with him. So what, he must be asking himself as he chews on his pigeon, is this girl doing here? What is she for? I've been observing this for more than 10 years now, and still I'm not sure I understand. Fear of the unknown? After all, Jeremy was packed off to a boys' school at the age of 7. He went to one of the last all-male colleges. His wife, call her Annabel, stays home with the sons and heirs, and privately, he thinks anything else is some kind of crime against the natural order of things.
Sorry, could I possibly have my wine back?
Jeremy is tapping me on the sleeve. I realize that I have been pushing my neighbor's glass towards the center of the table to prevent accidental spillage, a reflex from being with Emily and Ben.
Gosh, I'm terribly sorry. When you have children, you always think people are going to knock things over.
Oh, you have children?
Yes, two, actually.
Not planning any more, I hope.
This hangs in the air, this presumption that my fertility is part of his fiefdom, that he's paying me to be his alone, not to be carrying the young of a rival male. I feel like returning the compliment and kicking him so hard under the table that he's unable to have any more kids of his own. But the phrase, crushed balls, tends not to look good on the client report. Naturally, I say, clearing a throat from my lettuce, you will be my top priority, Jeremy. To Kate Reddy, from Jack Abelhammer.
Further to your communication on borrowing limits, I attach some thoughts on loans. Not my thoughts, I'm afraid, although they come pretty close to some of my own about the person who manages my fund. It is no gift I tender. A loan is all I can, but do not scorn the lender. Man gets no more from man. Oh, mortal man may borrow what mortal man can lend, and 'twill not end tomorrow, though sure enough 'twill end. If death and time are stronger, a love may yet be strong. The world will last for longer, but this will last for long.
To Jack Abelhammer, from Kate Reddy. Thank you for your thoughts about the loan. As your fund manager, I should point out that the value of your investment can go up as well as down. The market is quite depressed at the moment, but I will be in the US soon and may be available to discuss raising levels of exposure. It's a beautiful poem. K. Kisses. 3:44 a.m. Have left the children alone asleep in the house and just popped in to work. Stuff to do. It can't wait. I won't be long. 20 minutes, maybe 40 tops. They won't even notice I'm gone. The office is silent except for the sighs and shunts of machines making machine love to each other in the half-light. With no distractions, I work with great efficiency, figures swarming beneath my hands, an army of ants marshalled into platoons. File quarterly fund report, put screen to sleep, and steal back out of the building. Outside, the city is in a post-nuclear dawn, a warm gust of wind, some dancing litter, sky the colour of a saucepan. Spot a cab, fuzzy yellow light on the horizon. I wave as it approaches. It does not stop. Another cab sweeps past, blank as a hearse. Frantic now. Third cab nears. Step out into the road to make it stop. He swerves to avoid me, and I see his big pocked mushroom face mouthing through the glass. "You stupid cow," he spits out. "Can't you fucking look where you're going?" Sitting on the curb, weeping with frustration and self-pity, when a fire engine streaks up the street with an inconsolable wail. The engine stops, and the guys let me clamber aboard. I'm so grateful for the lift, I forget to tell them where I'm going, but we move swiftly through familiar roads till we reach my own. As we get close to our house, I can see a knot of people standing outside. Smoke pearls out of a bedroom window, Emily's window.
"Stand back, miss, we'll handle it,"
a man says. I am slapping my hands against the door. I am calling the children's names, but I can't hear for the siren. Can't hear myself scream. "Turn the siren off. Please, could somebody please turn that fucking siren off?"
"Kate, Kate, wake up. It's all right. It's all right."
"What?"
"It's all right, darling. You've had a bad dream."
I sit up. My nightie is a shroud of sweat. Inside my ribcage, there is a bird scrabbling to get out. "I left the children, Rich. There was a fire."
"It's okay, really, it's okay.
No, I left them by themselves. I went into work. I left them.
No, no, you didn't leave them. Listen, that's Ben crying. Listen, Kate.
It's true. From upstairs comes the siren call, the inconsolable wail of a teething baby, a one-man fire brigade. Chapter 21. Sunday. Day of rest, otherwise known as day of ceaseless manual labor. Chuck out extinct ready meals from fridge. Ready meals, as my sister-in-law Cheryl likes to call them. Swab down curious algae-like residue from glass shelves. Discard knuckle of parmesan, which smells of old people's home. Get rid of disgusting antibiotic-enriched happy chicken shapes that Paula feeds the children and make sure to hide right at the bottom of bin bag. For my vulnerable young, only free range. How many times must I tell her? Fill and empty washing machine 3 times. Cleaning lady, Juanita, has chronic back problem, 3.5 years, and quite rightly cannot be expected to carry heavy laundry around the house. Adult washing is outside Nanny's duties, although Paula does occasionally break strict demarcation to put in one of my hand-wash-only sweaters. I always consider complaining about this, but file instead under Pending Paula Grievances, Volume 3. Today I have invited Kirsty and Simon round for a relaxing lunch. Important to see friends. Remember there is more to life than work. Weaving of social fabric that strengthens sense of community, etc. Also important for children to see mummy at ease in domestic context. Build up glowing childhood memories instead of woman in black running out of door yelling instructions. Everything is totally under control. The recipe book is open like a Bible under the clean plastic lectern. Ingredients are in pleasing formation. Very dinky bottle of olive oil with Sienese silk ribbon. Am wearing charming Laura Ashley apron with retro floral print, which gives an ironic nod to the role of 50s homemaker while signalling jokey distance from appalling domestic servitude of women like my mum. Possibly. Also have planned casual weekend hostess outfit to change into seconds before guests arrive. Earl jeans, pink cashmere Donna Karen. Try to follow instructions for salsify leek and blue cheese phyllo tart, only Ben keeps rock climbing up my legs, using uncut nails as crampons. Every time I put him down, he gives a car alarm wail. There are those who make their own phyllo pastry, but they are like people who go in for bondage in the bedroom. You admire the effort and technique without necessarily wanting to do it yourself. I unwrap the pastry from its packet and brush one sheet with melted butter. Place another sheet on top. Very restful. Enter Emily with bulbous lower lip.
Where's Paula?
It's Sunday. Paula doesn't come in today, sweetheart. Mummy and Emily are going to make some lovely cookies together.
Don't want to. I want Paula.
The first time she said that, I swear I could feel the skewer going into my heart, and there is still nothing to rival it, the pain of your firstborn's infidelity. Well, I'd really like you to help me with the biscuits, darling. It'll be great fun. Through her great grey eyes, Emily weighs up the sight of her mother playing at being her mother.
Daddy said I could watch Rugrats.
All right, you can watch Rugrats if you put your blue dress on by the time Kirsty and Simon get here. 11:47 a.m. Everything under control. Return to recipe. Stir lemon juice and blue cheese into cold bechamel sauce. What bechamel sauce? Turn page. For bechamel sauce recipe, see page 74. What? Now they tell me. Mobile rings. It's Rod Task.
Bad time, Keddie?
No, absolutely fine. Ow! Ben, don't do that. Sorry, Rod. Go on.
I'm faxing through details of tomorrow's meeting, Keddie. We need you to be up to speed on performance, asset allocation, attribution and strategy outlook. Your kind of stuff. Guy Chase was singing your praises Friday night. Said how great you managed, considering.
Considering what?
Oh, you know how blokes get talking over a curry.
No, I do not know. Would love to go out with Rod and the team for the Friday night Indian, if only to keep that creep guy from stalking my job, but had to get home to read Harry Potter. Sudden ominous smell from oven. Don't worry, Rod. Everything is under control. See you tomorrow.
Take it easy, sweetie.
Open oven door to reveal disaster. Philo pastry case has become a petrified forest. Don't panic. Think, Kate, think. Run out of door yelling instructions. Can Richard please dress Ben and tidy the kitchen? 12:31 p.m. Back from the supermarket. Ben is dressed, but kitchen looks like a scene from Disney Goes to Dresden. Richard, I thought I asked you to tidy up. He looks up from the paper, amazed.
I have been tidying up. I've already put the CDs in alphabetical order.
Kick Brio train track under sofa, hurl rest of toys into utility room, and jam the door shut with the drying rack. Substitute M&S spinach quiche for salsify and Gruyere catastrophe. Now to make the dressing. Dinky bottle of olive oil has immovable crimson wax stopper. Try to pull out stopper with bottle opener, but merely shred flakes of red rind into baby leaf salad. Use teeth. No use. Bugger, bugger. Attack stopper with sharp knife. Miss bottle and slash back of hand instead. Looks like drunken suicide attempt. Search first aid drawer. Can only find one plaster. Mr. Bump. Run upstairs to change into relaxed hostess attire. Wriggle into new jeans, but no sign of Donna Karen pink cashmere sweater. Why is nothing ever in the right place in this house? 12:58 p.m. Find pink cashmere. Paula has hidden it at the back of the airing cupboard, and no wonder. Plainly, it has barely survived kids' wash. Now so shrunken, would only fit Mrs. Thomasina Tittlemouse or Ally McBeal. Go downstairs to discover Ben posting remaining blue cheese into the video. Emily screaming because Rugrats has jammed. No sign of Richard. Doorbell rings. Kirsty and Simon Bing are architect friends of Richard. The same age as us, they have no children, but only one exquisite grey-blue cat that drifts like smoke through the Japanese porcelain in their Clerkenwell loft. When we go to visit the Bings, I spend a lot of time shouting as Ben crawls up the open-plan staircase without any banister and peers gleefully into the abyss. There is an unspoken strain between the childless and those of us bowed down with infants. Before Emily was born, we rented a villa outside Siena with Kirsty and Simon, and our cooling relationship is occasionally warmed by memories of that week in the sun. These days, Rich and I, if we socialize at all, tend to hang out with people with kids, because they understand. The sudden need to produce pizza and tissues, often simultaneously, the unpredictable smells and naps, the moods that arrive like tanks. Kirsty and Simon always seem glad to see us, but I think it's fair to say that their goodbyes are particularly effusive, a prelude I always imagine to their explosion of shared relief as the door shuts on us and they can adjourn to their snot-free sofa. But today they have come to our place, where every piece of furniture is essentially a large handkerchief. Compared to how it usually looks, the kitchen is immaculate, but I see Kirsty direct an understanding smile at the single toy left in the middle of the floor, and, quite unreasonably, I want to slap her. Lunch goes fine, and I accept compliments for the M&S tart with surprisingly little shame. Well, I did make a huge effort to get it. The Bing's conversation ranges widely. Was it really a good idea to have the great court of the British Museum open in the evening? A failed experiment, according to Simon, who would be taken aback to learn that I have forgotten where the British Museum actually is. Then we're on to the stagnant state of current cinema. Kirsty and Simon have seen some French film about two girls working in a factory and were totally blown away by it. Rich reveals that he has seen it too. When did he find the time to do that?
Kate worked in a factory, didn't you, darling?
Oh, how fascinating, says Simon.
Not really. Plastic caps for aerosol cans. Very boring, very smelly, and very badly paid. The mildly awkward silence that follows is broken by Kirsty. So, how about you, Kate? She asks brightly. Seen any good movies? Oh, I enjoyed Crouching Tiger. I pause. And Crouching Dragon.
Hidden, murmurs Rich.
Hidden Tiger, I say. I loved the, Chinese bits. Mike Lee's very good, isn't he?
Ang, murmurs Rich.
I like Mary Poppins,
chimes in Emily, God bless her, running up from the other end of the kitchen, naked except for her little mermaid green silk tail.
Jane and Michael go to work with their daddy at the bank. It's near my mummy's work, and there's lots of pigeons.
She begins to sing loudly and tunelessly with a child's open-faced fearlessness.
Feed the birds, tuppence a bag, tuppence, tuppence, tuppence a bag. Do you feed the birds, Mummy?
No, I try to get men to come and kill them. Yes, of course, darling.
Can I come to your work?
Certainly not. Kirsty and Simon laugh politely. Kirsty picks at the sliver of orange Play-Doh stuck between the prongs of her dessert fork and wonders whether they shouldn't be starting to make a move. Must remember, avoid any social engagements which require clean clothes or clean furniture. Packing list for Euro Disney. Bread, milk, Calpol, stair carpet, call Dad, application form for Ben, nursery, call Jill Cooper, Clark. Thornton's Chocolate Ducklings. Chapter 22. How much does it cost? Wednesday, 10:35 p.m. Deborah calls me at home, which is weird because we scarcely talk these days, only email. Hearing her voice, I know instantly that something's wrong. So I ask, how's things? And with one deep breath, she's off. Oh, just the usual. Jim will be away over Easter tying up some deal in Hong Kong, and she has to drive the kids to Suffolk to stay with her family, and her father's had a stroke, and her mum's pretending to cope but can't, and they don't like to bother Deb because she's so busy and important, and of course she'd like to be bothered, but she's too busy at work where they're still holding out against giving her a full partnership, because that bastard Pilbert says there's a question mark over my commitment, and she's bloody earned that partnership, she really has. And then Anchor, the nanny she's had since Felix was one, has been stealing from her. Had she mentioned the stealing? No, she hadn't. Well, if she's honest, she's known about it since last summer, but not allowed herself to know, not wanting to know. First, it was just small amounts of cash she thought she'd left around the house and couldn't put her hands on. After that, other stuff went missing. A Walkman, a silver picture frame, that dinky digital camera Jim brought back from Singapore. The whole family, well, they'd just joked about their pilfering poltergeist, and Deb had some better locks put on the doors, because you never know. And then, just before Christmas, she'd mislaid her leather jacket, the lovely buttery one from Nicole Fai she couldn't possibly justify buying, and she could swear she hadn't left it anywhere. Called all the restaurants she'd been to, emptied her wardrobe, nothing. Joked bitterly to Anchor that she'd probably had early-onset Alzheimer's, and Anchor made her a cup of tea with three sugars. No wonder Slovakians have no teeth, and said sweetly, "You are a little tired only, I think. Not mad." So Deborah would never have found out if she hadn't popped home one afternoon between client meetings. Fiddling with her keys at the front door, she turned and saw Anchor walking down the street pushing her daughter in her buggy, and wearing her leather jacket. Said she felt so weak she could hardly move, but managed to get behind the dustbins and hide so Anchor didn't spot her. Then, last Saturday, when Anchor was away, Deb had gone into her room, like a burglar in her own home. And there in the cupboard, not even hidden at the back, was the jacket and a couple of Deb's better sweaters. In a drawer she found the camera and her grandmother's watch, the one with the silver fish for a long hand. So what did you say to her?
Nothing.
But, Deb, you have to say something.
Anchor's been with us for 4 years.
She brought Felix to the hospital the day Ruby was born. She's a member of the family.
Members of your family don't generally nick your stuff and then sympathize with you about it.
I'm shocked at the flatness of my friend's voice, all the fight ironed out of it.
I've thought about this, Kate. Felix is anxious enough already, with me being away all the time. His eczema gets so bad. And he loves Anchor. He really does.
Come off it! She's a thief, and you're her boss. You wouldn't put up with it at work for a minute.
I can live with her stealing from me, Kate. I can't live with the children being unhappy.
Anyway, that's enough of me. How are you?
I take a deep breath, and then I stop myself.
I'm fine.
Deborah rings off, but not before we've made another lunch appointment we won't keep. I put her name in my diary anyway, and around it I draw the dumb smiley face Deb always drew in the margin next to mentions of Joseph Stalin in our mutual European history notes in 1983. One of us got to go to the lecture, the other got the lie-in.
What is the cost when you pay someone else to be a mother to your children? Has anyone calculated it? I'm not talking about money. The money's a lot, but how much is the other thing?
Thursday, 4:05 a.m. Emily wakes me to tell me she can't sleep, so now that makes two of us. I check her forehead, but the fever turns out to be excitement over Disneyland Paris, where we are all heading later today, if I can get my jobs done in time. My daughter has wanted to go to Disneyland ever since she figured out that the Sleeping Beauty Castle at the end of all her videos was a real place. Now she climbs into bed beside me and whispers,
"Will Minnie Mouse know my name, Mummy?"
I say, "Of course she will," and my daughter burrows marsupially into the small of my back and drifts off, while I lie here, more awake by the second, trying to remember everything I need to remember. Passports, tickets, money, raincoats. Obviously, it will be raining. It's a holiday. Jigsaws, crayons, paper in case we get stuck in Channel Tunnel, dried apricots for nourishing snack, jelly babies for bribes, chocolate buttons for total meltdowns. Didn't Mrs. Pankhurst say something about women needing to stop being a servant class for men? Well, we tried, Emmeline. Boy, did we try. But all the time, women are carrying around the information that won't leave them alone. I reckon that inside a working mother's head, every day, is the control tower at Gatwick. MMR vaccinations, to jab or not to jab, reading schemes, shoe sizes, holiday packing, childcare, cunningly assembled from wings and prayers, all circling and awaiting further instruction from air traffic control. If women didn't bring them safely into land, well, the whole world would crash, wouldn't it? 12:27 p.m. The pigeon has laid two eggs. Elliptical in profile, they are startlingly white, with a faint blue tinge. The mother and father appear to be taking it in turns to sit on them. Watching them reminds me of the shifts Rich and I do with the kids when one of them is sick. By the end of today, I need to have written 4 client reports, sold a vast number of shares, with the markets melting down, company policy is to have more cash, and bought a flock of chocolate ducklings from Thornton's. Plus, Momo and I are working on another pitch for an ethical account in Italy, and I haven't even heard from Jack this morning, and I long to see the little envelope appear in the top right-hand corner of the screen that tells me he's out there thinking of me as I am thinking of him. What did it feel like before I was waiting for his messages? Waiting and waiting. Either waiting or reading his last message, or composing my reply, and then waiting again. No longer in a state of living, but in a constant state of waiting. The impatience like a hunger. Staring at the screen to summon the words into existence, willing him to speak. To Jack Abelhammer, from Kate Reddy. Jack, are you there? To Jack Abelhammer, from Kate Reddy. What are you thinking? Speak, damn it! To Jack Abelhammer, from Kate Reddy. Did I say something wrong? To Jack Abelhammer, from Kate Reddy. Hello? To Jack Abelhammer, from Kate Reddy.
What could you possibly be doing that's more important than talking to me?
Kisses.
To Kate Reddy, from Jack Abelhammer.
Being your slave, what should I do but tend upon the hours and times of your desire? I have no precious time at all to spend, nor services to do till you require.
To Jack Abelhammer, from Kate Reddy.
Okay, you're forgiven. That's lovely. Sonnet by Bill Gatesby, right? But let's get one thing clear. Any more silences that long, and you're in big trouble. In fact, you're a dead man. That's a promise. Kisses.
To Kate Reddy, from Jack Abelhammer.
Bill Gatesby, I find, has the emotional software to fit any occasion. As far as you're concerned, Catherine, I'm already in big trouble. If killing me means I can look forward to a personal appearance from my fund manager, then I'm prepared to die like a man. I knew you were going to Disneyland with the kids, so I figured you'd be caught up in the preparations and not welcome my messages. I try to think of you being happy without me, without letting it make me unhappy. Nor dare I question with my jealous thought where you may be or your affairs suppose, but like a sad slave stay and think of naught save where you are, how happy you make those. You write so lovingly about the children, Emily's reading, the way Ben tries to talk to you, that I know you're a great mom. And you notice so much. My mom stayed home and played bridge and drank vodka martinis with her friends. She was there all day and never really around for the three of us. Don't go romanticizing the stay-home parent. You can screw up whether you're near or far. Because you live in my head, you're very portable, you know. I find myself talking to you all the time. The worst thing is, I'm starting to think you can hear me.
Jack, kisses.
To Jack Abelhammer, from Kate Reddy.
I can hear you.
Chapter 23, Easter. Saturday lunch, Toad Hall Restaurant, Disneyland, Paris. Enthusiastic French kiss and passionate hug from a tall, dark stranger. Regrettably, his name is Goofy. Overcome with shyness at meeting her favorite cartoon characters, Emily hides behind her mother's legs and refuses to say hello. Seconds later, Paula enters the restaurant like a struck gong, reverberating with resentment. She agreed to accompany us to Euro Disney in much the same way the British agreed to give back India. I just know the short-term relief of having her here to help out will not be worth it for the long-term tactical disadvantage. I feel I have to spend the entire time apologizing profusely for things I haven't done. Sorry Ben woke everyone up last night with his snoring. Sorry room service is so slow. Sorry French people don't speak English. Oh, and I forgot to apologize for the rain. For that, I am truly sorry. Meanwhile, Paula sits back and observes my mothering skills with the fat, contented air of a driving instructor guiding a know-it-all pupil towards the inevitable prang. After 15 minutes of queuing for lunch in Toad Hall, mock baronial, gargoyles made of grey polystyrene, we reach the counter and Paula orders chicken nuggets for herself, Emily, and Ben. On the grounds that the chicken is more likely to be antibiotics in breadcrumbs, I decide to take a stand. Suggest that it might be nice for children to have quiche instead, on the off chance it will be made of ingredients from a farm rather than a test tube. If you say so, says Paula cheerfully. At the table, when I present Ben with quiche, his tiny, almost prim mouth contorts into a gash of grief. He starts those hiccupy sobs where he can barely take in air quick enough. French families sitting nearby, all with enfants in navy or grey linen, sitting up straight eating haricots verts,